And with a look in the backcountry and the fun with us, Drew Hardesty from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Hi, Drew.
Morning, Leslie. You know, with better visibility yesterday, people were able to get out and about into the mountains and had good evidence presented to them from the carnage and the wreckage that was Monday with the storm, some very large avalanches that ran naturally. A couple in particular, Leslie, what we call the Room of Doom, which is the headwall of Mineral Fork of Big Cottonwood Canyon. That probably was anywhere from 2 to 4 feet deep and estimated 500 feet wide as well, just across the street. And the Wilson Fork of Mill Creek, this one pulled out probably 2 to 3 feet deep and maybe 250 feet wide. These are called persistent slab avalanches for a reason. They're not the garden variety wind slabs or storm slabs, and they certainly stick around for days, weeks, even months, and we may start to see a wet avalanche cycle on them once spring rolls around. But with these temperatures, it seems far from spring. But regardless, we'll have a bottom line today of what we're calling areas of considerable danger. And that's most pronounced on the steep northwest to northeast facing slopes of the mid and upper elevations, but certainly not limited to that and moderate danger for the same avalanche problem elsewhere. So that's still requiring cautious route finding in the backcountry, and most old timers are sticking low angled slopes or choosing to avoid the Dragon's Lair altogether by riding the southerly aspects that doesn't really harbor the same persistent slab issue out there. Folks can always get this information and more off the web at utahavalanchecenter.org. And glad to see, Leslie, that we're going to be in an active weather pattern over the next number of days and hopefully weeks as well. So we'll keep our fingers crossed for the return of winter for weeks to come.
Yeah, we've got a lot of making up to do.
Hey. Yeah, well, it's not how you start, it's how you finish.
That's
so
right.
We'll keep our fingers crossed. Thanks.
All right, thanks, Drew. KPCW News Time now. Well, the Summit County Council yesterday sat down with a representative of Rocky Mountain Power to discuss two agreements to move the county toward the use of electricity derived from renewable sources. But at least one council member strongly objected to a provision that he says ties the county's hands so that it can't look at other sources of power. The council's objective is that by 2032, renewable energy would be obtainable and broadly used by residents and businesses of Summit County. To that end, the council and the power utility are considering a joint clean energy cooperation statement, pledging that they will work together on a variety of projects to achieve energy efficiency and a use of renewable energy. Secondly, a planned professional services agreement would allow Rocky Mountain to begin preliminary engineering and design work on these projects. However, County Council member Roger Armstrong objected to a paragraph in that cooperation agreement, saying that the county agrees not to implement other options apart from the power company. Those could include what is called community choice aggregation, where local entities would contract for alternative energy beyond a utility grid. Armstrong says that the county shouldn't agree to waive its rights to pursue other opportunities when the business and political climate of energy is changing so rapidly. Joining me now in the studio with an update on that, as well as some of the other issues discussed at yesterday's county council meeting, is Councilmember Roger Armstrong. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So your objection to this paragraph, why are you so adamant about this?
Because I had trouble when Park City agreed to this in their cooperation agreement a while back. We're dealing with an industry, the energy industry, that's changing constantly. I think we were on a certain track under the last presidential administration where we were making great headway. Under the current administration, many of those gains have been pared back, and it's uncertain where we're going. We'll have a new administration in another few years, and I suspect when you look at the winters that we're having, we need as many possibilities as we can on the table to make choices for our energy. And, you know, Rocky Mountain Power is already in a position where they're the monopoly utility in the state. They've got the right to set policy, and they influence policy very much at the state level. I think that's probably enough control. I don't think that the county needs to actually waive the possibility of being able to explore other alternative forms of energy. CCA right now is illegal to do in the state of Utah. Summit County couldn't do it if we wanted to. And it's probably a very, very significant lift at the legislature. So I think Rocky Mountain Power probably has plenty of protection there. without the county actually affirmatively waiving our rights. If something changed at the federal level, and, for example, federal legislation came out that said that states can't limit local jurisdictions from pursuing alternative or renewable energy projects, that would probably open the door for us to explore a lot of things, and I wouldn't want to take something major off the table. CCA is highly successful in California. A substantial number of jurisdictions have implemented it quite successfully there. So I'm just very uncomfortable at the start of a cooperation agreement and at the start of an engineering study where we've not agreed to do anything else to waive our rights now. If downstream, if after this engineering study is completed, Rocky Mountain Power is able to offer us a package of solutions that look like they're pretty comprehensive and work well for us, that would be the time to take up this issue and decide it. But I think 4 or 5 years in advance, it makes me very uncomfortable.
Well, and that was what some of your colleagues had said, that the agreement is just until January of 2022, so you're not stuck with it forever.
No, it slows us down for 4 years on this issue. And like I said, in 4 years, it's impossible to predict what may happen.
So is that a deal killer, or you were outvoted, or?
No. I think there were some supportive comments. They're going back to make some tweaks to the agreement. It's a deal killer for me. I won't speak for my other colleagues, but I could not support the current draft of the agreement as it is.
Okay. So as you mentioned, kind of there's Rocky Mountain Power needs to cut a deal to get an approval from the state legislature. So does that happen this session, or?
No, I think once we start this, the first thing, I don't know that Rocky Mountain Power has to get a lot of consents for them to do the engineering work, the studies. I mean, it first would be to, I think, identify what our overall needs are and then to come up with a series of recommendations as to how we can implement various kinds of renewable energy to meet our demands, whether that's, you know, I think Park City has had some conversations about locally sited solar systems. There are a whole range of things that they could do. One of the things that again, troubled me a little bit is in our prior conversation where we discussed this agreement a couple of months ago, I asked the representative from Rocky Mountain Power if CCA is essentially, as you said, a county will go out and buy interim power purchase agreements with various renewable providers wherever to provide electricity to us. I don't particularly want to be in the electrical business and have told Rocky Mountain Power that forever. And said, if you come up with something similar that's affordable to our residents, I think that's terrific. So a prior conversation we had, one of the questions I had for the representative was, can you outsource energy purchases? Could you buy energy from a geothermal supplier in Northern California or in Washington State and supply us with that energy? And they said, yes, we can do that. And then looking through the agreement, I did not see that. And when we asked Rocky Mountain Power's representative yesterday I reminded him that he had said okay to that and that it wasn't in the agreement. It's something he said he had to go back and check on. He wasn't sure now that they can do that. So it may be semantics. It may turn out that they can. But again, I'd like to make sure that we've got every possible choice available to us.
So the county pays some $31,000 into this. Doesn't seem like terribly a lot. What's that for?
That's for the engineering study. That's for them to do, to accumulate the data that they need to accumulate and do whatever other kinds of work to present us with sort of a framework of a plan.
So what happens next from here?
I think we will have another conversation about it in a couple of weeks and see where it goes.
All right. Taking a look at the rest of the agenda, what happened with the Jake Brake discussion? Or have we banned them in certain areas?
Well, they are banned in certain areas. Well, they're not banned. They're, you know, please don't use Jake Brakes. But, you know, they're a very, very important safety device, or a critical safety device on trucks. Chris Robinson was talking about, he drives a big truck for some of his ranching operations, and sometimes he's hauling pretty heavy loads, and he's got a Jake Brake on that truck, and he was describing how important it is if you're on a downhill stretch and you've got a substantial amount of weight behind you, that you really do need the extra push, that your brakes on a long downhill incline, your brakes are going to get worn out, and the engine probably isn't strong enough to slow a massive load in the back. So it's a really important safety device. We're told by UDOT, and I think the Trucking Association told Derek, that older trucks create the most noise. They're the ones with straight pipes, and new technology has started to soften that, and most trucks now are two or three years old. They're fairly new, so that's becoming less of a problem. So the sign that was requested over on 248 just west of the Wasatch County line, I don't think we're going to do that. Part of the problem is when you request a sign from UDOT, if they agree to give you the sign, the local jurisdiction requesting the sign has to promise to enforce it. And we got a memorandum from Lieutenant Hemingway at the Sheriff's Office saying that from a practical standpoint, it would be very difficult for the Sheriff's Office to enforce that kind of noise ordinance. There's going to be a truck that goes by. You're going to have somebody identifying the truck, what time it was, getting some other information about the truck, making the report, and then somebody's going to have to follow up with it. From a practical standpoint, it's hard to do. And even if you were able to do it, from a prosecution standpoint, it's difficult to prosecute. So I think that for a variety of reasons, it's likely not to work there. The rest of the discussion was, if we're going to wander down the path of requesting these signs, what would the roads look like? I mean, would we do it on a 10% grade or an 8% grade? And Derek proposed that it's a 5% grade or less for 3,000 feet or less, that if it fits within those parameters from a safety standpoint, it's probably something that we can do. And then we'll get into the issues of enforcement and the other things.
So where did this come from? Was it from residents that live along 248 there?
It was a resident that has a home, again, just west of the Wasatch County line on 248. And, you know, we've got a lot of construction activity, and my guess is it's probably a lot of dump trucks that are coming in. They may be a little bit older, and they're making noise that is disturbing his peace, and he's asking for some help.
All right. The consent agreement for Silver Creek property owner George Mount, the question of how much density does he have in the multifamily still seems elusive. And I guess that's because the amount of development is set by the limits on setbacks and height and the impervious surface area of the lots and the design being able to meet code. So did we come up with a number?
We did not. And I think that we'll leave that to the Planning Commission. He'll come up with a plan and a proposal. Right now he's proposing, my understanding, is about 24 units. Over those three lots. That doesn't sound unreasonable to me, but it's not my job. That's something the Planning Commission will get into as he comes forward with plans.
Okay. And we're talking about multifamily?
Yes.
Workforce
exactly.
Housing, market value homes?
We didn't talk about that again. I think that's probably a conversation that the Planning Commission will have. We didn't impose those requirements on it. This has been going through a process for a long time. He has four lots over there. He acquired those lots in 1965. There was no zoning out there. There are plat notes on it that talk about it being zoned for, not zoned, that talk about it being appropriate for commercial. He got one opinion from the state ombudsman's office in, I think, 2011 that allowed him commercial uses on one of the parcels, not necessarily because of the plat note, but because of something called equitable estoppel. The county had been operating in a way and telling him that commercial was essentially available there, and so the county was stopped from not telling him that, from taking another position. So he already had commercial on that lot, and then, you know, he came forward looking for commercial on the other three. That was going through the process. That was likely to be I think that was likely to be resolved in his favor, and the county attorney's office stepped in and started conversations with him, and I think they all decided that multifamily probably satisfies a number of needs out there and would be appropriate.
So has he signed up to be part of that new sewer system?
He has not, but he's close enough that he would probably be required to be part of that new sewer system. We spent some of the time examining how close he was to the existing sewer lines out there. As you know, there's a new sewer system out there. And if you're within 300 feet, you have to attach to sewer if it's available. It appears that all three of those lots are within that range, so they should attach to sewer. And for 24 multifamily units, I don't think you could do septic. It just wouldn't work.
Let's look at the appointments. For the East County Planning Commission, the council reappointed Don Sargent and made a new appointment, Amy Raldach.
Raldach, yeah.
Raldach. Why were these the favored candidates?
You know, Don has done a great job, and he's got a terrific background as the community development director. Generally, if somebody is doing a good job and they reapply, I think we like to reward that kind of effort. So it made sense. Don is, again, very dedicated to this. Amy is, you know, we had great candidates that came in, and we discussed all of them. to some degree after the interviews, and that's really encouraging. We're getting people with excellent backgrounds, people that are really concerned about what's going on, people that have spent some time examining the issues on the eastern side of the county and have a good understanding of them. I think if you look at Amy's background, she spent some time on the Oakley City Council. They've dealt with sewer out there. They've dealt with water issues. They've dealt with development. I think Oakley, frankly, is one of the best-run municipalities that we have in Summit County generally. And I think they do a terrific job. And I've seen Amy in meetings out there that I've attended when the county has had business before the Oakley City Council. She's very, very smart. She asks great questions. And I think she's just a great addition to the Planning Commission.
And then for the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, Council reappointed Ryan Dickey and made a new appointment of John Cusera.
Yep.
And why John, I guess? Because you did not appoint a previous planning commissioner, Colin DeFord. And, I mean, if you make the argument that Don Sargent, that he knows what he's doing, Colin would be one of those people who knows what he's doing.
I think that's fair. I think just in terms of, I don't want to go too deep into the closed session discussion, but, you know, I think generally I will say that across the board, I think we'd like to look at bringing younger people onto various boards and commissions. I think that's helpful to us. John has participated in a number of things. He's come before us. I think he's just a really good fit for us right now. And I think generally as we look at how things are run in this community, I think there's some responsibility that we have to bring along the next generation of leadership. And I think that this is a good way to start that.
All right. Anything else that you wanted to mention?
I don't think so. It's great to see you.
All right. Roger, thanks for your time. Well, Utah lawmakers setting this year's state budget estimate they will have more than $500 million in surplus tax collections to work with. Lawmakers released estimates yesterday showing a $453 million surplus to spend on ongoing costs like salaries and $128 million for one-time projects like construction. Senate Budget Chairman Jerry Stevenson says a lot of requests are being made for the money and all of the projects from lawmakers will not be funded. The extra money does not include $25 to $80 million extra the state is expected to collect because of the major overhaul of the nation's tax code passed by Congress in December. Deseret News reporting GOP legislative leaders are proposing to use some of that money to trim Utah's individual and corporate tax rates to 4.95%. That's down from 5%. That would cost about $55 million. Joining me now in the studio, Todd Halber, business administrator from Park City School District, who is spending a lot of time down at the state legislature tracking some of those education bills. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So what does this extra money mean for education?
Well, hopefully it'll find its way into education as everyone's competing for their priorities and issues. It'll be interesting to see how much of that makes it to public education. The Subappropriations Committee actually had recommended a number of items above and beyond what they had been allocated in the committee. So they had the earlier estimates from December. Now that the February estimates are out, it looks as though more of those items could be funded. So it'll be interesting to see how that rolls out. Right now they have on their list a 3% increase in the WPU. We were hoping for at least 2.5% for the budget considerations here at the Park City School District. So that's in the positive direction. Hopefully more of that will show up in the WPU. We know that equalization has been a topic, and there are two different bills out there addressing that. This funding would actually help Senator Fillmore's bill. He's looking for more than $36 million for equalization. The committee had only authorized or recommended $31 million. And so differences like that could be smoothed out pretty quickly with this additional money.
Yeah, so a 3% increase in the WPU, what does that mean for Park City?
So Park City, that would mean somewhere in the range of $400,000 additional money. And again, we needed 2.5. Just to cover the commitments that we had made in compensation and additional staffing that came in place this year. So that's all moving in a positive direction.
Yeah. Does it say anything about teacher salaries in terms of education? Because we had heard at one point that money would be directly for teachers.
Sure. And I think that conversation is still out there. The Appropriations Subcommittee took up that conversation over the summer during their interim period, as well as had different ideas of how the legislature might actually increase teacher pay by about $2,000 on the salary schedule. Right now, that's kind of lost in the wash of all the other competition of ideas. I think it may have just turned into the 3% WPU and give the opportunity for local school boards to identify how much compensation should come out of that.
Yeah, I think there's still a real fear, though, just in terms of the lack of teachers that we have available to teach. And anything else happening in terms of encouraging people to become teachers?
Not that I've seen financially. And so I think that will be left to us as local school boards to address the challenges that we're facing.
Yeah, and what about any pathways to become a teacher, maybe differently than going to school for it?
Yeah, so the State Board of Education had a piece of legislation. Now the House bill just escaped my mind here. But they're looking at redoing licensure in the state. And they're describing it more as a streamlining and going into the idea of walking away, not walking away, but less of the use of the idea of endorsements and going in the direction of credentialing. There's been a lot of talk on the national level of micro-credentialing. So you have a very specific area of expertise that you would become a qualified teacher in that very narrow area of education, and that would then be a badge that you have on your license to then teach and maybe demand different compensation, go towards the direction of differentiated compensation. But I don't think the school board's to that point yet of differentiated compensation, but definitely looking at credentialing as a new licensure method.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about equalization. You said there's a couple of bills out there and to do that would do what?
Correct. So there are two bills, one from Senator Fillmore and one from Representative Brad Last. Senator Fillmore's bill takes the increase, like we just talked about here, additional money coming in through income tax, and directing that into the voted and board guarantee programs. So that would go to school districts who have low assessed valuations but high tax effort and aren't able to generate the same tax yield as, say, a Park City can. So that's one idea. So it's taking money that comes from the natural growth in income tax. Representative Brad Last's bill, on the other hand, is looking at property tax growth. So allowing the basic rate to stay fixed, and as assessed valuations go up, it would generate more revenue, and that new revenue would then go through the equalization process. So they both have the same distribution of the money to those low assessed valuations, high tax effort districts, but the source is totally different. Fillmore's is on the side of income tax, and Last's is on the side of property tax.
Yeah, and we see that the Representative Last's, that's basically the whole RDA kind of formula funding, right? Right, where you take kind of tax increments and, right, freeze it and
sure,
then...
Sure, mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. So the idea of incremental pieces of property tax, yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Where are we with an oversight committee? Because this is something that you had expressed concern about, and it wouldn't apply to just school boards, but county councils.
Municipality, yeah. Counties, yeah, across the board. And all of those groups all rallied against the bill, and last night about 3, almost 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the bill failed in the House. So that concern now is evaporated. Hopefully it doesn't come back in some other form. But we're pleased to see that going. That oversight was just very, very heavy on looking at the legislative actions of local government. And so there are other avenues to pursue that oversight, and this was unnecessary.
Yeah, it felt like it was just some isolated incidents. And, you know, instead of just dealing with those, that you know, it was kind of this blanket coverage.
Yeah, hit everybody. And sometimes that's what comes out of the state legislature. It is an isolated incident that needs a statewide solution. Well, not always. Yeah, there might be an isolated issue that needs an isolated solution.
Of course, we're reporting this morning a Wasatch High School student in custody after a classmate alerted authorities that this student was threatening gun violence on social media. Anything being talked about with regard to school safety? I know that it's a topic on the school board's agenda for Tuesday.
Correct. Yeah, so at the legislative level, there's a piece of legislation going through that would improve or allow a different type of locking mechanisms on doors. So right now, under code, having a deadbolt on a door is not allowed. But this legislation would allow for that type of security so that if a teacher is in a lockdown mode, they bring their students into their room. Beyond just having the door locked itself, there could be other locking mechanisms put in place to keep that room secure. And so we'll see where that goes. That's about the only one that I'm aware of that's very proactive in addressing school safety at the legislative level. For the school district, you know, as we get together looking at the budget, the board had already allocated about $3 million for improvements on security with perimeter security, front entranceway security, systems to secure doors, check-in security measures. All of those are rolling along and being implemented as we move forward. As we get into the budget conversation, we'll probably look at the next level of things. We have a consultant that will talk to us about further improvements, what we're doing well, what we could do more of, or what we've missed and need to take into consideration. He'll be there on Tuesday, so you know, if you want to hear the latest on that, that would be a good meeting to come and attend. At this point, we've set aside about $1 million in our capital budget to pick up any other additional recommendations that may come out of the discussion.
Yeah. The bill that you were talking about in the state legislature, is that something that would be funded?
Oh, of course not. And so it's an allowance within the code, within building code, to put those types of measures in place. So it wouldn't be mandatory or required, but it's an opportunity to enhance security at buildings.
Yeah. And, you know, a news story that I had seen on school safety recently, I mean, talked about doors that would automatically lock, mm-hmm. right? And so that deters anybody, you know, from getting into buildings. And basically, and it just showed a piece of red tape that was put onto the floor that showed that if students were behind that red line, there was no way that a shooter could even see them and to make a target of them. I mean, that seemed pretty darn simple.
Very much so. And so, and we look at that. We have a number of buildings that have windows. We prefer natural light into the classroom for educational purposes and improve the environment. But then it also invites people to look in. And so we've oscillated back and forth on, you know, how do we secure those situations? How do we make them less visible, more visible? What is the right approach? But there are definitely low-cost solutions that are out there, very creative minds and people who have really thought through this. And so we're looking forward to our consultant to come and advise us some more.
Okay. Anything else that you wanted to mention?
I think it's been a very interesting session this year. There hasn't been major overhauls of the education system. We're not looking at changing school grading. We're not changing parental rights. We're not changing things that, you know, that are just foundational to the education system. So it's been a little quiet, if you will.
Oh, I also just wanted to mention, this is Senate Bill 144, local funding of education technology, basically allowing school districts to use revenue from debt service or the capital local levy to fund technology programs. So this is giving you a little bit more freedom in how to spend tax dollars?
And there's probably some debate as to whether we could do that already. You know, we use our capital fund for our one-to-one initiative, so we're already buying technology on a regular basis, making sure the students have the appropriate technology in the classrooms. To bring it into debt service, you could already bond for capital improvement. So if you needed infrastructure for technology, say servers or routers or running lines and things like that, that was already possible. I think this bill just makes it clear that you can do that.
Okay. Thanks, Tom.
Great.
It's 8:43. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. The Jordan-L Special Service District manages the water and wastewater systems not only within the Jordan-L District, but four others, serving nearly 2,000 customers in five districts. In the studio with me, with an update, I have the district's general manager, Ron Phillips. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning.
We were just talking about this off air. You were named the new general manager back in 2015. Haven't seen you, so welcome.
Thank you.
You actually come from Vail. You served there for many years as a town manager.
Correct, yeah.
So that's your background, is in management and budgeting as opposed to engineering?
Yeah, well, I'm a planner by education and some experience, but got into management as well, and actually went to Fort Collins after Vail and managed transportation services in that city. So I've got a varied background.
Yeah. As you arrived, two, 3 years ago, the district was plagued by lawsuits from property owners who had been foreclosed on by the district before your arrival. I mean, have you been able to resolve all of those?
Yes, there have been 14 of those. including appeals. And we're just now in the process of settling the last of those. All the others have been either dismissed or a summary judgment found in the district's favor. And one of them with the bondholders on the area, what we call the Area C properties that were foreclosed on when the landowners were unable to pay their assessments. That was settled last year, and now that land has been sold and satisfied all those, all the bonds that were in question, and we're just delighted to be past all that.
Yeah, and again, the problems arose when a new sewer, a water reclamation district was built to serve the forthcoming
right.
development, but then things blew apart, and again, no development happened because of the recession, and
right.
then nobody had development to pay for the assessments, and that's when the district had to pay its
right.
bonds,
so,
yeah?
Rather than paying the bonds, the district ended up foreclosing on all the property that was not paying their assessments. The bonds were issued to build the sewer infrastructure and the water reclamation facility. That was all built, and then the recession hit, and development stopped, and it just put everyone in a really difficult position. So we are now, as of last month, as a matter of fact, past that, the land is sold to a developer, and the district, fortunately, is out of that land-holding business.
So when do we flip the switch for the sewer treatment plant?
We are planning on doing that this coming fall.
And how many actual connections did you need to make that worthwhile?
Well, we have sufficient connections on all the development that's happening in Wasatch County on Highway 248 in that area and Hideout, and the development of the Jordan Owl Ridge area above the river there along Highway 32. So we believe that we have enough to get the plant operating and have it going finally.
Yeah. Is it old technology at this point?
No, it's still very, very recent and good technology. So yeah. We're pleased with that.
So all of those connections have just been rerouted to the facility?
They've been routed to the Heber Valley plant near Midway.
All right. In terms of growth, let's talk a little bit about it. Of course, we've got the huge Mayflower project. We're talking 3,000-4,000 units here. Nearly all of those parcels have been sold. In terms of supplying the water to that development, mm-hmm. do you guys have what you need?
Yes. They have water reserved through the district. We have a water reservation program where landowners can reserve water rights to serve their future developments. And once it develops, then the payments change from a water reservation fee to the monthly fee for water and wastewater.
What if they didn't make a reservation, or was that a required condition of approval or something?
Well, it's a required, either they reserve water or they go out in the market and buy water rights. And either way is acceptable to us. So with the Mayflower Mountain property, which is BLX Mayflower, they're doing both. They have water reserve, but they're also in the process of buying water rights for their development, because reserving water costs so much per year, which is much cheaper than buying the water rights. But if you're going to go for 20 or 20 plus years, it's probably more cost effective to buy water rights and not continue paying that annual
right.
reservation fee.
And then so the Mayflower, I mean, they have the water for the residential development, but what about all the snowmaking? I mean, we're talking about some 300 acres of skiing there.
I don't know their exact plans, but my guess is that they will use a combination of reserved water through the district and water rights they're buying for snowmaking. But I'm not privy to their plans on that yet.
Park City Municipal, one of your water customers, do
yes.
you have enough water to continue servicing Park City's needs?
Yes, we do.
So that's for the long term.
We're committed to that, and it's under contract, and that's Park City is one of our excellent customers, and we plan to serve them well.
And then the water comes from what? The strawberry? I mean, it just kind of feeds its way down into the Jordan L Basin?
Well, actually, most of the water we're using now comes from the Ontario Mine Drain Tunnel, which, of course, is under Park City, but drains out near Jordan L Reservoir, where we have a water treatment facility that treats the mine water first for the metals that are in it. And we use that pre-treated water for snowmaking, which we send to Deer Crest and to Deer Valley. And then the finished water, the finished treated water, is used to serve our culinary customers, including Park City.
Yeah. So you have to deal with the same problems that Park City does with the antimony and arsenic and all of that other stuff.
Correct.
Huh?
Yep.
Yeah. What are the biggest ones that are challenging you there from the Ontario
Those,
line?
Magnesium to a certain extent. So, but our plant is very efficient and does a great job of removing those metals. All of the water coming out of the mine drain tunnel has to be treated before it's released into Jordan L Reservoir. So that's part of the purpose of that treatment plant. And then we have the finished treated water that goes into the culinary system.
Okay. And then we saw a request for a proposal go out for a new administrative facility. You've just outgrown your existing.
Well, our offices are located in the wastewater treatment facility, the water reclamation facility. So once it starts up, we need to get our administrative offices out of there and into another location. And since we own a considerable amount of land there, in that area on Old Highway 40, we're planning to build an office building there to serve our needs.
Okay. So how much have you budgeted for that?
We anticipate it'll probably be between $500,000 and $600,000.
Okay. And then hope to have it before this fall? I mean,
We hope so. We'll see.
We're
going to try to put it on a fast track once we get an architect selected and get started and try to get it done.
Okay. Ribbon cutting ceremony then for the new facility?
Oh, maybe. Okay. It's not a major facility. It'll be a...
Oh, you mean the treatment plant?
Oh.
Yeah. When you flip the switch.
Yeah. We may have to do that. We'll invite you.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
I don't believe so. We're making progress, and we're glad that a lot of those difficult situations are behind us.
All right. Ron Phillips is the general manager with the Jordan L Special Services District. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
Well, coming up Saturday night at the Park City Eccles Center, singer, songwriter, activist, and author Dar Williams bringing her songs and stories and community wisdom. She joins me now on the phone. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Yeah. So tell us what to expect Saturday night. Is it a concert? Is it a community conversation? A little bit of both?
Mostly concert. I think afterwards I'm going to hang out and talk with people about what's going on in Park City right now, and I'm looking forward to that as well. But the concert, I'm bringing along a great keyboard player named Julie Wolf that a lot of people know from her work with the Indigo Girls and all sorts of Ani DeFranco, and so she's going to be with me, and I think it's going to be more music. But, you know, I've been around and looking at and talking with people about where they live and how things are going right now in the United States.
Right. You spent the last 20 years or so on the road and then wrote the book about that traveling, What I Found in 1,000 Towns. At what point did you realize that you had a book? I mean, was it after visiting 1,000 towns?
You know, at that point, I'd only visited about 860, and I was like, oh. So I started visiting towns just so I could get myself up to speed. You know, there was this thing that I recognized that I called positive proximity, and there's other words that sociologists turn out to have had for it, you know, high trust or bridging social capital and things like that. But what I was seeing is that in towns where people realize that having neighbors, having people living side by side with them and all of their different skill sets and differences, that they had something good on their hands, that having all sorts of people around you is good. When I went to places that had what I called positive proximity, I saw those towns thriving. You know, I saw them having more fun, being more stable, resilient, and very unique. And I watched them grow from nothing, you know, drug deals on every corner and boarded up downtown to really exciting places all over the United States and cities as well.
So those towns that don't have that positive proximity, I mean, what is it that they're missing?
They're missing opportunities to find one another. I mean, that's what I argue for. So what I've discovered is that you can't just go, we want, you know, love, we want peace, we want civility. What I found is that the best thing to do is to find this, you know, first off, find a couple of spaces where like-minded people can tilt their conversations towards what they want to see in their towns and cities. And, you know, there was literally a cupcake shop with a little index card in the corner I saw in Washington State that said, come here on Tuesday nights if you just want to talk about the town you love and the town you want to see. And that was a town that was starting to find its, you know, its downtown prosperity. So I feel like towns that start that way do well. And then when they dig into their identities in terms of their food, their history, their architecture, you know, their beauty, people start to have conversations that I say are more proximal than partisan, and they start to find a trust for each other and for living where they live, and a pride and a sense of their own identity that helps them, you know, grow the good, grow the positive proximity, and start a positive feedback loop.
Yeah, give me a couple more examples then of how towns are kind of creating that community, more than just the sign in the cupcake shop. What else have you seen?
Right, right, because that sounds a little slight. You know, I always go back to Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, because the steel mills closed down overnight, and there's these dark stories about, you know, lines of sandwiches in a sandwich shop at the end of every shift, and then overnight, you know, the sandwich shop is closed and nothing is there. And then came the traffic, you know, the drug deals and a lot of prostitution and, you know, an alternative economy. Some people, the first wave, from what I can tell, of new energy came when Phoenixville decided to reclaim its history, which doesn't sound like a very prosperous thing to necessarily do, but they went in and they got a historical district status to really, you know, focus on their architecture. And then they filled that architecture with these new stories and new things. And like they celebrate something called Blobfest, which is a celebration of the filming of The Blob. And it's this great sci-fi weekend. And they burn a giant phoenix that the whole town comes together to build over a period of 3 weeks. And it's 18 feet high, and they burn it down. It's a very important day for the businesses in town. And the town, you know, building all of that sense of relationship and that trust and that sense of fun even, you know, brought a lot of life to the businesses, to the downtown, to the confidence of the citizens, so that when a bunch of developers came in to bring in 300-plus rental properties right in town where the steel mill used to be, everyone said, oh, good. Okay, well, we're going to tell them how we're going to go forward with that project, so that these new citizens can sift in and be a part of the thing that we're so proud of. And, you know, watching them go from everything turning down to that kind of welcome of all these new citizens shows me what, you know, focusing on those spaces and that history and that sense of identity and celebration can do.
All right. Well, showtime is Saturday night. Park City Eccles Center. Tickets online at ecclescenter.org or contact the box office 435-655-3114. Really looking forward to the show, and I'm guessing the conversation just icing on the cupcake there. Dar Williams, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.